Listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 67, and this time around, we have three chapters of When the World Shook by H. Rider Haggard, chapters 14, 15, and 16. The chapters being slightly shorter this time around, for whatever reason. I've bunked off the last couple of shows, I'm sorry to say. Sometimes I just don't have the energy for time-consuming audio editing, or my time is taken up with other things, but I try to put on something, whether it be an Orson Welles radio play or whatever. But there are days I just do not get up early enough in the morning to start the stream in a timely fashion, and that's happened a couple of times just now. Well, I have a lot of comments, but I'm going to try and keep this short and just say, mostly, that the Enochian elements in here are very, very strong. The serpent can be the symbol of Asclepius the healer, but in context with the sons of wisdom and their pride and so on, I think there's a different implication here, mostly. Also, the description of the throne of the Lord Oro. In the city of Nyo, which means urine in Japanese, is essentially identical to a GTE telephone booth from the 1970s that I encountered. I'll probably have more commentary next time.
Chapter 14. The Underworld.
That night, we slept well and without fear, being quite certain that after their previous experience, the Orofenans would make no further attempts upon us. Indeed, our only anxiety was for Tommy, whom we could not find when the time came to give him his supper. Baston, however, seemed to remember having seen him following the glittering lady into the cave. This, of course, was possible, as certainly he had taken an enormous fancy to her and sat himself down as close to her as he could on every occasion. He even seemed to like the ancient Oro, and was not afraid to jump up and plant his dirty paws upon that terrific person's gorgeous robe. Moreover, Oro liked him, for several times I observed him pat the dog upon the head, as I think I have said, the only human touch that I had perceived about him. So we gave up searching and calling in the hope that he was safe with our supernatural friends. The next morning, quite early, the Lady Eva appeared alone. No, not alone, for with her came our lost Tommy, looking extremely spry and well at ease. The faithless little wretch just greeted us in a casual fashion, and then went and sat by Eva. In fact, when the awkward Baston managed to stumble over the end of her dress, Tommy growled at him and showed his teeth. Moreover, the dog was changed. He was blessed with a shiny black coat, but now this coat sparkled in the sunlight like the Lady Eva's hair.
"The glittering lady is all very well, but I'm not sure that I care for a glittering dog. It doesn't look quite natural," said Baston, contemplating him.
"Why does Tommy shine, lady?" I asked. "Because I washed him in certain waters that we have, so that now he looks beautiful and smells sweet," she answered, laughing. It was true, the dog did smell sweet, which I may add had not always been the case with him, especially when there were dead fish about. Also, he appeared to have been fed, for he turned up his nose at the bits we had saved for his breakfast. "He has drunk of the life water," explained Eva, "and will want no food for 2 days." Bickley pricked up his ears at the statement and looked incredulous. "You do not believe, O Bickley," she said, studying him gravely. "Indeed, you believe nothing. You think my father and I tell you many lies. Baston here, he believes all. Humphrey, he is not sure. He thinks to himself, 'I will wait and find out whether or no these funny people cheat me.'" Bickley colored and made some remark about things which were contrary to experience, also that Tommy in a general way was rather a greedy little dog. "You too like to eat, Bickley." This was true. He had an excellent appetite. "But when you have drunk the life water, you will care much less."
"I am glad to hear it," interrupted Baston, "for Bickley wants a lot of cooking done, and I find it tedious."
"You eat also, lady," said Bickley. "Yes, I eat sometimes because I like it, but I can go weeks and not eat when I have the life water. Just now, after so long a sleep, I am hungry. Please, give me some of that fruit. No, not the flesh. Flesh I hate." We handed it to her. She took two plantains, peeled and ate them with extraordinary grace. Indeed, she reminded me, I do not know why, of some lovely butterfly drawing its food from a flower. While she ate, she observed us closely. Nothing seemed to escape the quick glances of those beautiful eyes. Presently she said, "What, O Humphrey, is that with which you fasten your neck dress?" And she pointed to the little gold statue of Osiris that I used as a pin. I told her that it was a statuette of a god named Osiris and very, very ancient, probably quite 5,000 years old, a statement at which she smiled a little. also that it came from Egypt. Ah, she answered, is it so? I asked because we have figures that are very like to that one, and they also hold in their hands a staff surmounted by a loop. They are figures of Sleep's brother, Death. So is this, I said. Among the Egyptians, Osiris was the god of death. She nodded and replied that doubtless the symbol had come down to them. One day you shall take me to see this land which you call so very old, or I will take you, which would be quicker, she added. We all bowed and said that we should be delighted. Even Baston appeared anxious to revisit Egypt in such company, though when he was there it seemed to bore him. But what she meant about taking us I could not guess, nor had we time to ask her, for she went on, watching our faces as she spoke. The Lord Oros sends you a message, strangers. He asks whether it is your wish to see where we dwell. He adds that you are not to come if you do not desire or if you fear danger. We all answered that there was nothing we should like better, but Baston added that he had already seen the tomb. Do you think, Baston, that we live in a tomb, because we slept there for a while, awaiting the advent of you wanderers at the appointed hour?
I don't see where else it could be unless it is farther down that cave, said Baston. The top of the mountain would not be convenient as a residence.
It has not been convenient for many an age, for reasons that I will show you. Think now, before you come. You have naught to fear from us, and I believe that no harm will happen to you, but you will see many strange things that will anger Bickley because he cannot understand them, and perhaps will weary Baston because his heart turns from what is wondrous and ancient. Only Humphrey will rejoice in them, because the doors of his soul are open, and he longs. What do you long for, Humphrey?
That which I have lost and fear I shall never find again, I answered boldly.
I know that you have lost many things. Last night, for instance, you lost Tommy, and when he slept with me he told me much about you and others.
That is ridiculous, broke in Baston. Can a dog talk?
Everything can talk, if you understand its language, Baston. But keep a good heart, Humphrey, for the bold seeker finds in the end. Oh, foolish man, do you not understand that all is yours if you have but the soul to conceive and the will to grasp? All, below, between, above, even I know that, I who have so much to learn.
So she spoke, and became suddenly magnificent. Her face, which had been but that of a super-lovely woman, took on grandeur. Her bosom swelled, her presence radiated some subtle power, much as her hair radiated light. In a moment it was gone, and she was smiling and jesting.
Will you come, strangers, where Tommy was not afraid to go, down to the underworld? Or will you stay here in the sun? Perhaps you will do better to stay here in the sun, for the underworld has terrors for weak hearts that were born but yesterday, and feeble feet may stumble in the dark.
I shall take my electric torch, said Baston, with decision, and I advise you fellows to do the same. I always hated cellars, and the catacombs at Rome are worse, though full of sacred interest.
Then we started, Tommy frisking on ahead in a most provoking way as though he were bored by a visit to a strange house and going home, and Eva gliding forward with a smile upon her face that was half mystic and half mischievous. We passed the remains of the machines, and Bickley asked her what they were.
Carriages, in which once we travelled through the skies, until we found a better way, and that the uninstructed used to the end, she answered carelessly, leaving me wondering what on earth she meant.
We came to the statue and the sepulchre beneath without trouble, for the glint of her hair, and I may add of Tommy's back, were quite sufficient to guide us through the gloom. The crystal coffins were still there, for Baston flashed his torch and we saw them, but the boxes of radium had gone.
Let that light die, she said to Baston. Humphrey, give me your right hand, and give your left to Bickley. Let Baston cling to him, and fear nothing.
We passed to the end of the tomb, and stood against what appeared to be a rock wall, all close together, as she directed.
"Fear nothing," she said again.
But next second I was never more full of fear in my life, for we were whirling downwards at a speed which would have made an American elevator attendant turn pale.
"Don't choke me," I heard Bickley say to Baston, and the latter's murmured reply of,
"I never could bear these moving staircases and tube lifts. They always make me feel sick."
I admit that for my part I also felt rather sick, and clung tightly to the hand of the glittering lady. She, however, placed her other hand upon my shoulder, saying in a low voice,
"Did I not tell you to have no fear?"
Then I felt comforted, for somehow I knew that it was not her desire to harm and much less to destroy me. Also, Tommy was seated quite at his ease with his head resting against my leg, and his absence of alarm was reassuring. The only stoic of the party was Bickley. I have no doubt that he was quite as frightened as we were, but rather than show it, he would have died.
"I presume this machinery is pneumatic," he began,
when suddenly and without shock we arrived at the end of our journey. How far we had fallen, I'm sure I do not know, but I should judge from the awful speed at which we travelled that it must have been several thousand feet, probably 4 or 5.
"Everything seems steady now," remarked Baston, "so I suppose this luggage lift has stopped. The odd thing is that I can't see anything of it. There ought to be a shaft, but we seem to be standing on a level floor.
The odd thing is, said Bickley, that we can see it all. Where the devil does the light come from, thousands of feet underground?
I don't know, answered Baston, unless there is natural gas here, as I am told there is at a town called Medicine Hat in Canada.
Natural gas be blowed, said Bickley. It is more like moonlight, magnified 10 times. So it was. The whole place was filled with a soft radiance, equal to that of the sun at noon, but gentler and without heat. Where does it come from? I whispered to Eva. Oh, she replied, as I thought evasively, it is the light of the underworld, which we know how to use. The earth is full of light, which is not wonderful, is it, seeing that it's hard as fire? Now look about you. I looked, and leant on her harder than ever, since amazement made me weak. We were in some vast place whereof the roof seemed almost as far off as the sky at night. At least, all that I could make out was a dim and distant arch which might have been one of cloud. For the rest, in every direction stretched vastness, illuminated, far as the eye could reach, by the soft light of which I have spoken, that is, probably for several miles. But this vastness was not empty. On the contrary, it was occupied by a great city. There were streets much wider than Piccadilly, all bordered by houses, though these, I observed, were roofless. Very fine houses, some of them, built of white stone or marble. There were roadways and pavements worn by the passage of feet. There, further on, were marketplaces or public squares. And there, lastly, was a huge central enclosure, 100 or 200 acres in extent, which was filled with majestic buildings that looked like palaces or town halls. And in the middle of them all, a vast temple with courts and a central dome. For here, notwithstanding the lack of necessity, its builders seemed to have adhered to the overworld tradition and had roofed their fane. And now came the terror. All of this enormous city was dead. Had it stood upon the moon, it could not have been more dead. None paced its streets, none looked from its window places, none trafficked in its markets, none worshipped in its temple, swept, garnished, lighted, practically untouched by the hand of time, here where no rains fell and no winds blew, it was yet a howling wilderness. For what wilderness is there to equal that which once has been the busy haunt of men? Let those who have stood among the buried cities of Central Asia, or of Anuradhapura in Ceylon, or even midst the ruins of Salamis on the coast of Cyprus, answer the question. But here was something infinitely more awful, a huge human haunt in the bowels of the earth, utterly devoid of human beings, and yet as perfect as the day when these ceased to be.
I do not care for underground localities, remarked Baston, his gruff voice echoing strangely in that terrible silence. But it does seem a pity that all these fine buildings should be wasted. I suppose that their inhabitants left them in search of fresh air.
Why did they leave them? I asked of Eva. Because death took them, she answered solemnly. Even those who live 1,000 years die at last, and if they have no children, with them dies the race.
Then were you the last of your people? I asked.
Inquire of my father, she replied, and led the way through the massive arch of a great building.
It led into a walled courtyard, in the center of which was a plain cupola of marble, with a gate of some pale metal that looked like platinum mixed with gold. This gate stood open. Within it was the statue of a woman, beautifully executed in white marble, and set in a niche of some black stone. The figure was draped as though to conceal the shape, and the face was stern and majestic, rather than beautiful. The eyes of the statue were cunningly made of some enamel which gave them a strange and lifelike appearance. They stared upwards, as though looking away from the earth and its concerns. The arms were outstretched. In the right hand was a cup of black marble, in the left a similar cup of white marble. From each of these cups trickled a thin stream of sparkling water, which two streams met and mingled at a distance of about 3 feet beneath the cups. Then they fell into a metal basin, which, although it must have been quite a foot thick, was cut right through by their constant impact, and apparently vanished down some pipe beneath. Out of this metal basin, Tommy, who gambolled into the place ahead of us, began to drink in a greedy and demonstrative fashion. "The life water?" I asked, looking at our guide. She nodded and asked in her turn, "What is the statue and what does it signify, Humphrey?" I hesitated, but Baston answered,
"Just a rather ugly woman who hid up her figure because it was bad. Probably she was a relation of the artist who wished to have her likeness done, and sat for nothing."
"The goddess of health," suggested Bickley. "Her proportions are perfect. A robust, thoroughly normal woman." "Now, Humphrey," said Eva. I stared at the work and had not an idea. Then it flashed on me with such suddenness and certainty that I am convinced the answer to the riddle was passed to me from her, and did not originate in my own mind. "It seems quite easy," I said in a superior tone. "The figure symbolizes life, and is draped because we only see the face of life. The rest is hidden. The arms are bare because life is real and active. One cup is black and one is white, because life brings both good and evil gifts. That is why the streams mingle, to be lost beneath in the darkness of death. The features are stern and even terrifying rather than lovely, because such is the aspect of life. The eyes look upward and far away from present things, because the real life is not here.
Of course one may say anything, said Baston, but I don't understand all that.
Imagination goes a long way, broke in Bickley, who was vexed that he had not thought of this interpretation himself. But Eva said, I begin to think that you are quite clever, Humphrey. I wonder whence the truth came to you, for such is the meaning of the figure and the cups. Had I told it to you myself, it could not have been better said. And she glanced at me out of the corners of her eyes. Now, strangers, will you drink? Once that gate was guarded, and only at a great price or as a great reward were certain of the highest blood given the freedom of this fountain, which might touch no common lips. Indeed, it was one of the causes of our last war, for all the world which was desired this water which now is lapped by a stranger's hound.
I suppose there is nothing medicinal in it, said Baston. Once when I was very thirsty, I made a mistake and drank 3 tumblers of something of the sort in the dark, thinking that it was Apollinaris, and I don't want to do it again.
Just the sort of thing you would do, said Bickley. But, Lady Eva, what are the properties of this water?
It is very health-giving, she answered, and if drunk continually, not less than once each 30 days, it wards off sickness, lessens hunger, and postpones death for many, many years. That is why those of the high blood endured so long and became the rulers of the world, and that, as I have said, is the greatest of the reasons why the peoples who dwelt in the ancient outer countries and never wished to die made war upon them to win this secret fountain. Have no fear, O Baston, for you see I will pledge you in this water.
Then she lifted a strange-looking, shallow metal cup, whereof the handles were formed of twisted serpents, that lay in the basin, filled it from the trickling stream, bowed to us, and drank. But as she drank I noted with a thrill of joy that her eyes were fixed on mine as though it were me she pledged, and me alone. Again she filled the cup with a sparkling water, for it did sparkle like that French liqueur in which are mingled little flakes of gold, and handed it to me. I bowed to her and drank. I suppose the fluid was water, but to me it tasted more like strong champagne, dashed with Chateau Yquem. It was delicious. More, its effects were distinctly peculiar. Something quick and subtle ran through my veins, something that for a few moments seemed to burn away the obscureness which blurs our thought. I began to understand several problems that had puzzled me, and then lost their explanations in the midst of light. Inner light, I mean. Moreover, of a sudden it seemed to me as though a window had been opened in the heart of that glittering lady who stood beside me. At least, I knew that it was full of wonderful knowledge, wonderful memories, and wonderful hopes, and that in the latter two of these I had some part. What part I could not tell. Also, I knew that my heart was open to her, and that she saw in it something which caused her to marvel and to sigh. In a few seconds, 30 perhaps, all this was gone. Nothing remained except that I felt extremely strong and well, happier, too, than I had been for years. Mutely I asked her for more of the water, but she shook her head, and, taking the cup from me, filled it again and gave it to Bickley, who drank. He flushed, seemed to lose the self-control, which was his very strong characteristic, and said in a rather thick voice, "Curious. But I do not think at this moment there is any operation that has ever been attempted which I could not tackle single-handed and with success." Then he was silent, and Baston's turn came. He drank rather noisily after his fashion and began,
"My dear young lady, I think the time has come when I should expound to you."
Here he broke off and commenced singing very badly, for his voice was somewhat raucous.
From Greenland's icy mountains, from India's coral strand, where Afric's sunny fountains roll down their golden sand.
Ceasing from melody, he added,
I determined that I would drink nothing intoxicating when I was on this island, that I might be a shining light in a dark place, and now I fear that quite unwittingly I have broken what I look upon as a promise.
Then he too grew silent.
Come, said Eva, my father, the Lord Oro, awaits you.
We crossed the court of the Water of Life, and mounted steps that led to a wide and impressive portico, Tommy frisking ahead of us, in a most excited way for a dog of his experience. Evidently the water had produced its effect upon him as well as upon his masters. This portico was in a solemn style of architecture which I cannot describe, because it differed from any other that I know. It was not Egyptian and not Greek, although its solidity reminded me of the former, and the beauty and grace of some of the columns of the latter. The profuseness and rather grotesque character of the carving suggested the ruins of Mexico and Yucatan, and the enormous size of the blocks of stone those of Peru and Baalbek. In short, all the known forms of ancient architecture might have found their inspiration here, and the general effect was tremendous.
The Palace of the King, said Eva, whereof we approach the great hall.
We entered through mighty metal doors, one of which stood ajar, into a vestibule which from certain indications I gathered had once been a guard or perhaps an assembly room. It was about 40 feet deep by 100 wide. Thence she led us through a smaller door into the hall itself. It was a vast place without columns, for there was no roof to support.
The walls of marble or limestone were sculptured like those of Egyptian temples, apparently with battle scenes, though of this I am not sure, for I did not go near to them. Except for a broad avenue along the middle, up which we walked, the area was filled with marble benches that would, I suppose, have accommodated several thousand people. But they were empty. Empty, and oh, the loneliness of it all. Far away at the head of the hall was a dais enclosed and, as it were, roofed in by a towering structure that mingled grace and majesty to a wonderful degree. It was modeled on the pattern of a huge shell. The base of the shell was the platform, behind were the ribs, and above the overhanging lip of the shell. On this platform was a throne of silvery metal. It was supported on the arched coils of snakes, whereof the tails formed the back and the heads the arms of the throne. On this throne, arrayed in gorgeous robes, sat the Lord Oro, his white beard flowing over them, and a jeweled cap upon his head. In front of him was a low table on which lay graven sheets of metal, and among them a large ball of crystal. There he sat, solemn and silent in the midst of this awful solitude, looking in very truth like a god as we conceive such a being to appear. Small as he was in that huge expanse of buildings, he seemed yet to dominate it, in a sense to fill the emptiness which was accentuated by his presence. I know that the sight of him filled me with true fear, which it had never done in the light of day, not even when he arose from his crystal coffin. Now, for the first time, I felt as though I were really in the presence of a being supernatural. Doubtless the surroundings heightened this impression. What were these mighty edifices in the bowels of the world? Whence came this wondrous, all-pervading, and translucent light, whereof we could see no origin? Whither had vanished those who had reared and inhabited them? How did it happen that of them all, this man, if he were a man, and this lovely woman at my side, who, if I might trust my senses and instincts, was certainly a woman, alone survived of their departed multitudes? The thing was crushing. I looked at Bickley for encouragement, but got none, for he only shook his head. Even Baston, now that the first effects of the life water had departed, seemed overwhelmed, and muttered something about the halls of Hades. Only the little dog Tommy remained quite cheerful. He trotted down the hall, jumped on the dais, and sat himself comfortably at the feet of its occupant.
"I greet you," Oro said, in his slow, resonant voice. "Daughter, lead these strangers to me. I would speak with them." Chapter 15. Oro in His House.
We climbed onto the dais by some marble steps, and set ourselves down in four curious chairs of metal that were more or less copied from that which served Oro as a throne, at least the arms ended in graven heads of snakes. These chairs were so comfortable that I concluded the seats were fixed on springs. Also, we noticed that they were beautifully polished.
"I wonder how they keep everything so clean," said Baston, as we mounted the dais. "In this big place it must take a lot of housemaids, though I don't see any. But perhaps there is no dust here."
I shrugged my shoulders, while we seated ourselves, the Lady Eva and I on Oro's right, Bickley and Baston on his left, as he indicated by pointing with his finger.
"What say you of this city?" Oro asked after a while of me.
"We do not know what to say," I replied. "It amazes us. In our world there is nothing like to it."
"Perchance there will be in the future, when the nations grow more skilled in the arts of war," said Oro darkly.
"Be pleased, Lord Oro," I went on, "if it is your will to tell us why the people who built this place chose to live in the bowels of the earth instead of upon its surface."
"They did not choose. It was forced upon them," was the answer. "This is a city of refuge that they occupied in time of war, not because they hated the sun. In time of peace, and before the barbarians dared to attack them, they dwelt in the city Pani, which signifies above. You may have noted some of its remaining ruins on the mount and throughout the island. The rest of them are now beneath the sea, but when trouble came, and the foe rained fire on them from the air, they retreated to this town, Nyo, which signifies beneath."
"And then?"
"And then they died. The water of life may prolong life, but it cannot make women bear children. That they will only do beneath the blue of heaven, not deep in the belly of the world, where nature never designed that they should dwell. How would the voices of children sound in such halls as these? Tell me, you Bickley, who are a physician."
I cannot imagine children in such a place, and if born here they would die," said Bickley.
Oro nodded. "They did die,
and if they went above to Pani, they were murdered. So soon the habit of birth was lost, and the sons of wisdom perished one by one. Yes, they who ruled the world and by tens of thousands of years of toil had gathered into their bosoms all the secrets of the world, perished, till only a few, and among them I and this daughter of mine, were left.
And then?
Then, Humphrey, having power to do so, I did what long I had threatened, and unchained the forces that work at the world's heart, and destroyed them who were my enemies and evil, so that they perished by millions, and with them all their works. Afterwards we slept, leaving the others, our subjects, who had not the secret of this sleep, to die, as doubtless they did in the course of nature or by the hand of the foe. The rest you know.
Can such a thing happen again?
Asked Bickley, in a voice that did not hide his disbelief.
Why do you question me, Bickley, you who believe nothing of what I tell you, and therefore make wrath?
Still, I will say this, that what I cause to happen I can cause once more. Only once, I think, as perchance you shall learn before all is done. Now, since you do not believe, I will tell you no more of our mysteries. No, not whence this light comes, nor what are the properties of the water of life, both of which you long to know, nor how to preserve the vital spark of being in the grave of dreamless sleep, like a live jewel in a casket of dead stone, nor aught else. As to these matters, daughter, I bid you also to be silent, since Bickley mocks at us. Yes, with all this around him, he who saw us rise from the coffins still mocks at us in his heart. Therefore let him, this little man of a little day, when his few years are done, go to the tomb in ignorance, and his companions with him, they who might have been as wise as I am. Thus Oro spoke in a voice of icy rage, his deep eyes glowing like coals. Hearing him, I cursed Bickley in my heart, for I was sure that once spoken, his decree was like to that of the Medes and Persians, and could not be altered. Bickley, however, was not in the least dismayed. Indeed, he argued the point. He told Oro straight out that he would not believe in the impossible until it had been shown to him to be possible, and that the law of nature never had been and never could be violated. It was no answer, he said, to show him wonders without explaining their cause, since all that he seemed to see might be but mental illusions, produced he knew not how. Oro listened patiently, then answered, "Good. So be it, they are illusions. I am an illusion. Those savages who died upon the rock will tell you so. This fair woman before you is an illusion. Humphrey, I am sure, knows it, as you will also before you have done with her. These halls are illusions. Live on in your illusions, O little man of science, who, because you see the face of things, think that you know the body and the heart, and can read the soul at work within. You are a worthy child of tens of thousands of your breed, who were before you and are now forgotten." Bickley looked up to answer, then changed his mind and was silent, thinking further argument dangerous, and Oro went on. "Now I differ from you, Bickley, in this way. I, who have more wisdom in my finger-point than you with all the physicians of your world added to you, have in your brains and bodies, yet desire to learn from those who can give me knowledge. I understand from your words to my daughter that you, Bastin, teach a faith that is new to me, and that this faith tells of life eternal for the children of Earth. Is it so?"
"It is," said Bastin eagerly. "I will set out—"
Oro cut him short with a wave of the hand.
"Not now, in the presence of Bickley, who doubtless disbelieves your faith, as he does all else, holding it, with justice or without, to be but another illusion. Yet you shall teach me, and on it I will form my own judgment."
"I shall be delighted," said Bastin.
Then a doubt struck him, and he added,
"But why do you wish to learn? Not that you may make a mock of my religion, is it?"
"I mock at no man's belief, for I think that what men believe is true for them. I will tell you why I wish to hear of yours, since I never hide the truth. I, who am so wise and old, yet must die, though that time may be far away, still I must die, for such is the lot of man born of woman, and I do not desire to die. Therefore I shall rejoice to learn of any faith that promises to the children of Earth a life eternal beyond the Earth. Tomorrow you shall begin to teach me. Now leave me, strangers, for I have much to do." And he waved his hand toward the table. We rose and bowed, wondering what he could have to do down in this luminous hole, he who had been for so many thousands of years out of touch with the world. It occurred to me, however, that during this long period he might have got in touch with other worlds. Indeed, he looked like it.
"Wait," he said. "I have something to tell you. I have been studying this book of writings or world pictures,"
and he pointed to my atlas, which, as I now observed for the first time, was also lying upon the table.
"It interests me much. Your country is small, very small. When I caused it to be raised up, I think that it was larger.
but since then that seas have flowed in. Here Bickley groaned aloud.
This one is much greater, went on Oro, casting a glance at Bickley that must have penetrated him like a searchlight. Then he opened the map of Europe and with his finger indicated Germany and Austria-Hungary.
I know nothing of the peoples of these lands, he added, but as you belong to one of them and are my guests, I trust that yours may succeed in the war.
What war? We asked with one voice.
Since Bickley is so clever, surely he should know better than an illusion such as I. All I can tell you is that I have learned that there is war between this country and that,
and he pointed to Great Britain and to Germany upon the map,
also between others.
It is quite possible, I said, remembering many things, but how do you know?
If I told you, Humphrey, Bickley would not believe, so I will not tell. Perhaps I saw it in that crystal, as did the necromancers of the early world, or perhaps the crystal serves some different purpose, and I saw it otherwise, with my soul. At least, what I say is true.
Then who will win? Asked Baston.
I cannot read the future, preacher. If I could, should I ask you to expound to me your religion, which probably is of no more worth than a score of others I have studied, just because it tells of the future? If I could read the future, I should be a god, instead of only an earth lord.
Your daughter called you a god, and you said that you knew we were coming to wake you up, which is reading the future, answered Baston.
Every father is a god to his daughter, or should be. Also in my day, millions named me a god because I saw farther and struck harder than they could. As for the rest, it came to me in a vision. Oh, Bickley, if you are wiser than you think you are, you would know that all things to come are born elsewhere, and travel hither like the light from stars. Sometimes they come faster before their day into a single mind, and that is what men call prophecy. But this is a gift which cannot be commanded, even by me. Also, I did not know that you would come. I knew only that we should awaken, and by the help of men, for if none had been present at that distant hour, we must have died for lack of warmth and sustenance.
I deny your hypothesis in toto, exclaimed Bickley,
but nobody paid any attention to him.
My father, said Eva, rising and bowing before him with her swan-like grace, I have noted your commands, but do you permit that I show the temple to these strangers, also something of our past?
Yes, yes, he said. It will save much talk in a savage tongue that is difficult to me. But bring them here no more without my command, save Baston only. When the sun is 4 hours high in the upper world, let him come tomorrow to teach me, and afterwards, if I so desire. Or if he wills, he can sleep here.
I think I would rather not, said Baston hurriedly. I make no pretense to being particular, but this place does not appeal to me as a bedroom. There are degrees in the pleasures of solitude, and, in short, I will not disturb your privacy at night.
Oro waved his hand, and we departed down that awful and most dreary hall.
I hope you will spend a pleasant time here, Baston, I said, looking back from the doorway at its cold, illuminated vastness.
I don't expect to, he answered, but duty is duty, and if I can drag that old sinner back from the pit that awaits him, it will be worth doing. Only I have my doubts about him. To me he seems to bear a strong family resemblance to Beelzebub, and he's a bad companion, week in and week out.
We went through the portico, Eva leading us, and past the fountain of life water, of which she cautioned us to drink no more at present, and to prevent him from doing so, dragged Tommy past it by his collar. Bickley, however, lingered under the pretense of making a further examination of the statue. As I had seen him emptying into his pocket the contents of a corked bottle of quinine tabloids which he always carried with him, I guessed very well that his object was to procure a sample of this water for future analysis. Of course I said nothing, and Eva and Baston took no note of what he was doing. When we were clear of the palace, of which we had seen only one hall, we walked across an open space made unutterably dreary by the absence of any vegetation or other sign of life, towards a huge building of glorious proportions that was constructed of black stone or marble. It is impossible for me to give any idea of the frightful solemnity of this domed edifice, for, as I think I have said, it alone had a roof, standing there in the midst of that brilliant, unvarying, and most unnatural illumination which came from nowhere and was yet everywhere. Thus, when one lifted a foot, there it was between the sole of the boot and the floor, or to express it better, the boot threw no shadow. I think this absence of shadows was perhaps the most terrifying circumstance connected with that universal and pervading light. Through it, we walked on to the temple. We passed three courts, pillared all of them, and came to the building which was larger than St. Paul's in London. We entered through huge doors which still stood open, and presently found ourselves beneath the towering dome. There were no windows. Why should there be in a place that was so full of light? There was no ornamentation. There was nothing,
except black walls, and yet the general effect was magnificent in its majestic grace.
"In this place," said Eva, and her sweet voice went whispering round the walls and the arching dome, "were buried the kings of the Sons of Wisdom. They lie beneath, each in his sepulchre. Its entrance is yonder," and she pointed to what seemed to be a chapel on the right. "Would you wish to see them?"
"Somehow I don't care to," said Baston. "The place is dreary enough as it is without the company of a lot of dead kings."
"I should like to dissect one of them, but I suppose that would not be allowed," said Bickley.
"No," she answered. "I think that the Lord Oro would not wish you to cut up his forefathers."
"When you and he went to sleep, why did you not choose the family vault?" asked Baston.
"Would you have found us there?" she queried by way of answer. Then, understanding that the invitation was refused by general consent, though personally I should have liked to accept it, and have never ceased regretting that I did not, she moved toward a colossal object which stood beneath the center of the dome. On a stepped base, not very different from that in the cave, but much larger, sat a figure draped in a cloak on which was graven a number of stars, doubtless to symbolize the heavens. The fastening of the cloak was shaped like the crescent moon, and the footstool on which rested the figure's feet was fashioned to suggest the orb of the sun. This was of gold or some such metal, the only spot of brightness in all that temple. It was impossible to say whether the figure were male or female, for the cloak, falling in long straight folds, hid its outlines. Nor did the head tell us, for the hair also was hidden beneath the mantle, and the face might have been that of either man or woman. It was terrible in its solemnity and calm, and its expression was as remote and mystic as that of Buddha, only more stern. Also, without doubt, it was blind. It was impossible to mistake the sightlessness of those staring orbs. Across the knees lay a naked sword, and beneath the cloak the arms were hidden. In its complete simplicity, the thing was marvelous. On either side, upon the pedestal, knelt a figure of the size of life. One was an old and withered man with death stamped upon his face. The other was a beautiful naked woman, her hands clasped in the attitude of prayer, and with vague terror written on her vivid features. Such was this glorious group, of which the meaning could not be mistaken. It was fate, throned upon the sun, wearing the constellations as his garment, armed with a sword of destiny, and worshipped by life and death. This interpretation I set out to the others. Eva knelt before the statue for a little while, bowing her head in prayer, and really I felt inclined to follow her example, though in the end I compromised, as did Bickley, by taking off my hat, which, like the others, I still wore from force of habit, though in this place none were needed. Only Baston remained covered.
"Behold the god of my people," said Eva. "Have you no reverence for it, O Baston?"
"Not much," he answered, "except as a work of art. You see, I worship fate's master. I might add that your god doesn't seem to have done much for you, Lady Eva, as out of all your greatness there's nothing left but two people and a lot of old walls and caves."
At first she was inclined to be angry, for I saw her start. Then her mood changed, and she said with a sigh,
"Fate's master, where does he dwell?"
"Here, amongst other places," said Baston. "I'll soon explain that to you."
"I thank you," she replied gravely. "But why have you not explained it to Bickley?"
Then, waving her hand to show that she wished for no answer, she went on,
"Friends, would you wish to learn something of the history of my people?"
"Very much," said the irrepressible Baston, "but I would rather the lecture took place in the open air."
"That is not possible," she answered. "It must be here and now, or not at all. Come, stand by me. Be silent and do not move. I am about to set loose forces that are dangerous if disturbed."
Chapter 16. Visions of the Past.
She led us to the back of the statue and pointed to each of us where we should remain. Then she took her place at right angles to us, as a showman might do, and for a while stood immovable. Watching her face, once more I saw it, and indeed all her body, informed with that strange air of power, and noted that her eyes flashed, and that her hair grew even more brilliant than was common, as though some abnormal strength were flowing through it and her. Presently she spoke, saying,
"I shall show you first our people in the day of their glory. Look in front of you."
We looked, and by degrees the vast space of the apse before us became alive with forms. At first these were vague and shadowy, not to be separated or distinguished.
Then they became so real that, until he was reproved by a kick, Tommy growled at them and threatened to break out into one of his peals of barking. A wonderful scene appeared. There was a palace of white marble, and in front of it a great courtyard upon which the sun beat vividly. At the foot of the steps of the palace, beneath a silken awning, sat a king enthroned, a crown upon his head and wearing glorious robes. In his hand was a jeweled scepter. He was a noble-looking man of middle age, and about him were gathered the glittering officers of his court. Fair women fanned him, and to right and left, but a little behind, sat other fair and jeweled women who, I suppose, were his wives or daughters. "One of the kings of the Children of Wisdom, new crowned, receives the homage of the world," said Eva. As she spoke, there appeared, walking in front of the throne one by one, other kings, for all were crowned and bore scepters. At the foot of the throne each of them kneeled and kissed the foot of him who sat thereon, as he did so, laying down his scepter, which, at a sign, he lifted again and passed away. Of these kings there must have been quite 50, men of all colors and of various types, white men, black men, yellow men, red men. Then came their ministers bearing gifts, apparently of gold and jewels, which were piled on trays in front of the throne. I remember noting an incident. An old fellow with a lame leg stumbled and upset his tray, so that the contents rolled hither and thither. His attempts to recover them were ludicrous, and caused the monarch on the throne to relax from his dignity and smile. I mention this to show that what we witnessed was no set scene, but apparently a living piece of the past. Had it been so, the absurdity of the bedizened old man tumbling down in the midst of the gorgeous pageant would certainly have been omitted. No, it must be life, real life, something that had happened, and the same may be said of what followed. For instance, there was what we call a review. Infantry marched, some of them armed with swords and spears, though these I took to be an ornamental bodyguard, and others with tubes like savage blowpipes, of which I could not guess the use. There were no cannon, but carriages came by, loaded with bags that had spouts to them. Probably these were charged with poisonous gases. There were also some cavalry, too, mounted on a different stamp of horse from ours, thicker set and nearer to the ground, but with arched necks and fiery eyes, and, I should say, very strong. These, again, I take it, were ornamental. Then came other men upon a long machine, slung in pairs and armored sacks, out of which only their heads and arms projected. This machine, which resembled an elongated bicycle, went by at a tremendous rate, though whence its motive power came did not appear. It carried 20 pairs of men, each of whom held in his hand some small but doubtless deadly weapon that in appearance resembled an orange. Other similar machines which followed carried from 40 to 100 pairs of men. The marvel of the piece, however, were the aircraft. These came by in great numbers. Sometimes they flew in flocks like wild geese, sometimes singly, sometimes in line, and sometimes in ordered squadrons, with outpost and officer ships and an exact distance kept between craft and craft. None of them seemed to be very large, or to carry more than 4 or 5 men, but they were extraordinarily swift and as agile as swallows. Moreover, they flew as birds do by beating their wings, but again we could not guess whence came their motive power. The review vanished, and next appeared a scene of festivity in a huge illuminated hall. The great king sat upon a dais, and behind him was that statue of Fate, or one very similar to it, beneath which we stood. Below him, in the hall, were the feasters seated at long tables, clad in the various costumes of their countries. He rose and, turning, knelt before the statue of Fate. Indeed, he prostrated himself thrice in prayer. Then, taking his seat again, he lifted a cup of wine and pledged that vast company. They drank back to him, and prostrated themselves before him as he had done before the image of Fate. Only I noted that certain men, clad in sacerdotal garments not at all unlike those which are worn in the Greek church today, remained standing. Now all this exhibition of terrestrial pomp faded. The next scene was simple, that of the deathbed of this same king. We knew him by his weazened features. There he lay, terribly old and dying. Physicians, women, courtiers, all were there watching the end. The tableau vanished, and in place of it appeared that of the youthful successor amidst cheering crowds, with joy breaking through the clouds of simulated grief upon his face. It vanished also. "Thus did great king succeed great king for ages upon ages," said Eva. "There were 80 of them, and the average of their reigns was 700 years. They ruled the earth, as it was in those days. They gathered up learning, they wielded power, their wealth was boundless. They nurtured the arts, they discovered secrets, they had intercourse with the stars. They were as gods, but like the gods they grew jealous. They and their counselors became a race apart who alone had the secret of long life. The rest of the world and the commonplace people about them suffered and died. They of the household of wisdom lived on in pomp for generations, till the earth was mad with the envy of them. Fewer and fewer grew the divine race of the sons of wisdom, since children are not given to the aged and to those of an ancient outworn blood. Then the world said, They are great, but they are not many. Let us make an end of them by numbers, and take their place, and power, and drink of their life water that they will not give to us. If myriads of us perish by their arts, what does it matter, since we are countless? So the world made war upon the sons of wisdom. See!
Again a picture formed. The sky was full of aircraft, which rained down fire like flashes of lightning upon cities beneath. From these cities leapt up other fires that destroy the swift-traveling things above, so that they fell in numbers like gnats burned by a lamp. Still more and more of them came, till the cities crumbled away, and the flashes that darted from them ceased to rush upwards. The sons of wisdom were driven from the face of the earth. Again the scene changed. Now it showed this subterranean hall in which we stood. There was pomp here, yet it was but a shadow of that which had been, in the earlier days, upon the face of the earth. Courtiers moved about the palace, and there were people in the radiant streets and the houses, for most of them were occupied, but rarely did the vision show children coming through their gates. Of a sudden this scene shifted. Now we saw that same hall in which we had visited Oro not an hour before. There he sat, yes, Oro himself, upon the dais beneath the overhanging marble shell. Round him were some ancient counselors. In the body of the hall, on either side of the dais, were men in military array, guards without doubt, though their only weapon was a black rod, not unlike a ruler, if indeed it were a weapon, and not a badge of office. Eva, whose face had suddenly grown strange and fixed, began to detail to us what was happening in this scene in a curious monotone, such as a person might use who was repeating something learned by heart. This was the substance of what she said. The case of the sons of wisdom is desperate, but few of them are left. Like other men, they need food, which is hard to come by, since the foe holds the upper earth, and that which their doctors can make here in the shades does not satisfy them, even though they drink the life water. They die and die. There comes an embassy from the High King of the Confederated Nations to talk of terms of peace. See, it enters. As she spoke, up the hall advanced the embassy. At the head of it walked a young man, tall, dark, handsome and commanding, whose aspect seemed in some way to be familiar to me. He was richly clothed in a purple cloak, and wore upon his head a golden circlet that suggested royal rank. Those who followed him were mostly old men, who had the acute faces of diplomatists, but a few seemed to be generals. Eva continued in her monotonous voice. Comes the son of the King of the Confederated Nations, the prince who will be king. He bows before the Lord Oro. He says, Great and ancient monarch of the divine blood, heaven-born one, your strait and that of those who remain to you is sore, yet on behalf of the nations I am sent to offer you terms of peace, but this I may do only in the presence of your child, who is your heiress and the queen-to-be of the sons of wisdom. Here, in the picture, Oro waved his hand, and from behind the marble shell appeared Eva herself, gloriously apparelled, wearing royal ornaments and with her train held by waiting ladies. She bowed to the prince and his company, and they bowed back to her. More, we saw a glance of recognition pass between her and the prince. Now, the real Eva by our side pointed to the shadow Eva of the vision or the picture, whichever it might be called, a strange thing to see her do, and went on. The daughter of the Lord Oro comes. The prince of the nations salutes her. He says that the great war has endured for hundreds of years, between the children of wisdom fighting for absolute rule and the common people of the earth fighting for liberty. In that war many millions of the sons of the nations had perished, brought to their death by fearful arts, by wizardries, and by plagues sown among them by the sons of wisdom. Yet they were winning, for the glorious cities of the sons of wisdom were destroyed, and those who remained of them were driven to dwell in the caves of the earth, where with all their strength and magic they could not increase, but faded like flowers in the dark. The Lord Oro asks what are the terms of peace proposed by the nations. The prince answers that they are these: that the sons of wisdom shall teach all their wisdom to the wise men among the nations, that they shall give them to drink of the life water, so that their length of days also may be increased, that they shall cease to destroy them by sickness, and their mastery of the forces which are hid in the womb of the world. If they will do these things, then the nations on their part will cease from war, will rebuild the cities they have destroyed by means of their flying ships that rain down death, and will agree that the Lord Oro and his seed shall rule them forever, as the King of Kings. The Lord Oro asks if that be all. The prince answers that it is not all. He says that when he dwelt a hostage at the court of the Sons of Wisdom, he and the Divine Lady, the daughter of the Lord Oro and his only living child, learned to love each other. He demands and the nations demand that she shall be given to him to wife, that in a day to come he may rule with her, and their children after them. See, went on Eva in her chanting, dreamy voice, the Lord Oro asks his daughter if this be true. She says, Here the real Eva at my side turned and looked me straight in the eyes. That it is true,
that she loves the Prince of the Nations, and that if she lives 1,000,000 years she will wed no other man, since she who is her father's slave, in all else, is still the mistress of herself, as has ever been the right of her royal mothers. See again, the Lord Oro, the divine king, the ancient, grows wroth. He says that it is enough, and more than enough, that the barbarians should ask to eat of the bread of hidden learning, and to drink of the life water of the sons of wisdom, gifts that were given to them of old by heaven, whence they sprang in the beginning. But that one of them, however highly placed, should dare to ask to mix his blood with that of the divine lady, the heiress, the queen of the earth to be, and claim to share her imperial throne that had been held by her pure race from age to age, was an insult that could only be purged by death. Sooner would he give his daughter in marriage to an ape than to a child of the barbarians, who had worked on them so many woes and striven to break the golden fetters of their rule. Look again, continued Eva. The Lord Oro the Divine grows angrier still, which in truth he did, for never did I see such dreadful rage as that which the picture revealed in him. He warns, he threatens. He says that hitherto out of gentle love and pity he has held his hand, that he has strength at his command which will slay them, not by millions in slow war, but by tens of millions at one blow, that will blot them and their peoples from the face of the earth, and that will cause the deep seas to roll where now their pleasant lands are fruitful in the sun. They shrink before his fury, behold their knees tremble because they know that he has this power. He mocks them, does the Lord Oro. He asks for their submission here and now, and that in the name of the nations they should take the great oath which may not be broken, swearing to cease from war upon the sons of wisdom, and to obey them in all things to the ends of the earth. Some of the ambassadors would yield. They look about them like wild things that are trapped. But madness takes the prince. He cries that the oath of an ape is of no account, but that he will tear up the children of wisdom as an ape tears leaves, and afterwards take the divine lady to be his wife. Look on the Lord Oro, continued the living Eva. His wrath leaves him. He grows cold and smiles. His daughter throws herself upon her knees and pleads with him. He thrusts her away. She would spring to the side of the prince. He commands his counselors to hold her. She cries to the prince that she loves him and him only, and that in a day to come him she will wed and no other. He thanks her, saying that as it is with her, so it is with him, and that because of his love he fears nothing. She swoons. The Lord Oro motions with his hand to the guard. They lift their death rods. Fire leaps from them. The prince and his companions, all save those who were afraid and would have sworn the oath, twist and writhe. They turn black. They die. The Lord Oro commands those who are left to enter their flying ships, and bear to the nations of the earth tidings of what befalls those who dare to defy and insult him, to warn them also to eat and drink and be merry while they may, since for their wickedness they are about to perish. The scene faded, and there followed another, which really I cannot describe. It represented some vast underground place, and what appeared to be a huge mountain of iron clothed in light, literally a thing like an alp, rocking and spinning down a declivity, which farther on separated into two branches because of a huge razor-edge precipice that rose between. There, in the middle of this vast space, with a dazzling mountain whirling towards him, stood Oro encased in some transparent armor, as though to keep off heat, and with him his daughter, who under his direction was handling something in the rock behind her. Then there was a blinding flash, and everything vanished. All of this picture passed so swiftly that we could not grasp its details. Only a general impression remained. The Lord Oro, using the strength that is in the world whereof he alone has the secret, changes the world's balance, causing that which was land to become sea, and that which was sea to become land, said Eva, in her chanting unnatural voice. Another scene of stupendous and changing awfulness. Countries were sinking, cities crashing down, volcanoes were spouting fire. The end of the earth seemed to be at hand. We could see human beings running to and fro in thousands like ants. Then, in huge waves, hundreds and hundreds of feet high, the ocean flowed in and all was troubled yeasty sea. Oro carries out his threat to destroy the nations who had rebelled against him, said Eva. Much of the world sinks beneath the waves, but in place of it other lands arise above the waves, to be inhabited by the seed of those who remain living, in those portions of the earth that the deluge spared. This horrible vision passed, and was succeeded by one more, that of Oro standing in the sepulchre of the cave by the side of the crystal coffin, which contained what appeared to be the body of his daughter. He gazed at her, then drank some potion, and laid himself down in the companion coffin, that in which we had found him. All vanished away, and Eva, appearing to wake from some kind of trance, smiled, and in her natural voice asked if we had seen enough. "Quite," I answered, in a tone that caused her to say, "I wonder what you have seen, Humphrey. Myself I do not know, since it is through me that you see at all, and when you see, I am in you who see. Indeed, I replied. Well, I will tell you about it later.
Thank you so much, exclaimed Baston, recovering suddenly from his amazement. I have heard a great deal of these moving picture shows which are becoming so popular, but have always avoided attending them because their influence on the young is supposed to be doubtful, and a priest must set a good example to his congregation. Now I see that they can have a distinct educational value, even if it is presented in the form of romance.
How is it done? Asked Bickley, almost fiercely.
I do not altogether know, she answered. This I do know, however, that everything which has happened on this world can be seen from moment to moment at some point in the depths of space, for thither the sun's light takes it. There, too, it can be caught, and thence in an instant returned to Earth again, to be reflected in the mirror of the present by those who know how that mirror should be held. Ask me no more. One so wise as you, O Bickley, can solve such problems for himself.
If you don't mind, Lady Eva, said Baston, I think I should like to get out of this place, interesting as it is. I have food to cook up above and lots of things to attend to, especially as I understand I am to come back here tomorrow. Would you mind showing me the way to that lift or moving staircase?
Come, she said, smiling.
So we went past the image of fate, out of the temple, down the vast and lonely streets so unnaturally illuminated, to the place where we had first found ourselves on arrival in the depths. There we stood. A moment later, and we were whirling up as we had whirled down. I suppose that Eva came with us, though I never saw her do so, and the odd thing was that when we arrived in the sepulchre, she seemed already to be standing there waiting to direct us.
Really, remarked Baston, this is exactly like Maskelyne and Cook. Did you ever see their performance, Bickley? If so, it must have given you lots to explain for quite a long while.
Jugglery never appealed to me, whether in London or in Orofena, replied Bickley in a sour voice, as he extracted from his pocket an end of a candle, to which he set light.
What is jugglery? Asked Baston.
And they departed, arguing, leaving me alone with Eva in the sepulchre.
What have I seen? I asked her. I do not know, Humphrey. Everyone sees different things, but perhaps something of the truth.
I hope not, Eva, for among other things I seem to see you swear yourself to a man forever.
Yes, and this I did. What of it?
Only that it might be hard for another man.
Yes, for another man it might be hard. You were once married, were you not, Humphrey, to a wife who died?
Yes, I was married.
And did you not swear to that wife that you would never look in love upon another woman?
I did, I answered in a shamed voice. But how do you know? I never told you so.
Oh, I know you, and therefore guessed.
Well, what of it, Eva?
Nothing, except that you must find your wife before you love again, and before I love again I must find him whom I wish to be my husband.
How can that happen, I asked, when both are dead?
How did all that you have seen today in Nyo happen, she replied, laughing softly. Perhaps you are very blind, Humphrey, or perhaps we both are blind. If so, mayhap light will come to us. Meanwhile, do not be sad. Tomorrow I will meet you, and you shall teach me your English tongue, Humphrey, and other things.
Then let it be in the sunlight, Eva. I do not love those darksome halls of Nyo that glow like something dead.
It is fitting, for are they not dead? She answered, with a little laugh. So be it. Baston shall teach my father down below, since sun and shade are the same to him who thinks only of his religion, and you shall teach me up above.
I am not so certain about Baston and of what he thinks, I said doubtfully. Also, will the Lord Oro permit you to come?
Yes, for in such matters I rule myself. Also, she added meaningly, he remembers my oath that I will wed no man, save one who is dead. Now, farewell a while, and bid Baston be here when the sun is 3 hours high, not before or after.
Then I left her.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads.